probably about the right attitude I'd want from all students who left my class to have. It probably works pretty well. I was asked to talk about positioning yourself and your group and you producers with partners and with others in the industry, and I'm going to talk about that. I really like the theme of talking about continuing the advance. I'm going to talk in particular via a PowerPoint presentation across the next several minutes about two themes. They're important to you as you think about positioning yourself in the industry to continue to move forward. They're important for the industry to continue to move forward. And I want you to keep these two themes in mind as we go through some material. One is that you're going to have to be willing to change a little bit the way you do business and the way your product is priced and valued and the way you coordinate and interact with your adjacent and partners along the supply chain. Some of you aren't going to like some of the changes that I think we're going to see. But I think that theme of change in how we price and how we organize and how we coordinate has got to happen for the second major theme I want to focus on here to evolve and continue to evolve. And that speaks to consumer demand and being consumer-driven and continuing to have a demand pool that sucks new investment dollars into the Angus business in this country and gives you a decent chance to be profitable. I guess I could have treated them in the other order because I think in order to be consumer-driven and continue to enhance demand, and I'll spend some time on that, I think you have to probably be willing to change the way you do business and how you affiliate yourself with your allies and with your partners in the sector. So kind of keep those two thoughts in mind, if you will, please, as we start to go through. I kind of talked about mega trends and those two basic mega trends from a producer perspective. And this is what I just talked about, just to make sure that it didn't get lost in all of the noise that I generate and all of the comment that I make. There has been substantial change across the past 20 years, often controversial. We've got efforts ongoing now to legislate against some of these changes, but we're going to continue to see changes in the structure and organizational flow in the industry and how pricing gets done. And I'll talk about why that has to happen. And then we'll see trends and changes in the demand for beef. And I got to say to you that a primary contributor to the record high prices we've seen for calves and on up through the supply chain at various levels across the past 2 years has been that demand after a 20-year decline, demand having gone down for 20 consecutive years, it finally changed and turned back up in 1998. And I do a demand index for the industry and keep it posted on my website. And my latest quarterly demand index indicates that demand is up about 22% since 1998. You can put about $200 to $250 of value on a fed steer, which trickles down to $1.50 calves because of that increased demand across the past 6 years or so. You've got to keep that coming. You've got to keep that happening. You've got to keep demand growing to have the type of industry you want to see and participate in. So it's very important that we think about, deal with that notion a little bit. I'm going to have to be careful with my thumb on here. I want to make sure up front, and I think most of you in the room, I hope, are past this point now. Demand is not measured by per capita consumption. Per capita consumption measures supply and availability. It says nothing about the level of demand. And this industry has done itself a disservice in some quarters for a long time by not understanding that. And the people that write about this industry basically still don't understand that. So it's important that we appreciate that point. Demand has to take into account not only quantity consumed, but also the prices that are paid for the product. And boy, that bottom statement is important. It's key. It's graphic in its importance to you. The key is consumers' willingness to pay.
If they're going to be willing to pay high record prices for the beef offering, they got to like it, it's got to perform, and it can't have a fair product failure rate of 25%, which we've had all too often in the fresh beef offering across the past 20, 25 years. One of the things that the Angus Advance has done has decreased that probability of product failure when it gets to the point that somebody's cutting that steak and putting it in the mouth and trying to chew it. And we need to appreciate that we still got a much too high product failure rate, and we'll talk about that. Consumers are not willing to pay unless they're confident they're going to have a pleasurable, enjoyable, consistent, high-quality eating experience. I'm going to set up a little framework and walk you through the framework and then a few pieces of data, moving up toward building the points I'm going to build in the presentation. And I'm watching the time up here, so I want to move on through this and get to the point that we've got at least 10 minutes, 15 minutes maybe, for some questions from you toward the end, and I'll try to get that done. We know that demand is decreasing when price and quantity are both decreasing. Every year, there is a demand curve that has about that shape at some vertical level on that scatter plot, on that graph. If we had a year, for example, in which the fed cattle market averaged $80, just to give a simple example, and our per capita consumption, i.e. our per capita availability, was 65 pounds, then if any move down into the left in that yellow quadrant constitutes a decrease in demand. We spent 20 years moving down to the left in this industry, and I'll show you that. We don't want that as a direction. We don't want, after we adjust prices for inflation, to see that annual price-quantity relationship that the demand curve had to have gone through. We don't want to see that moving toward the origin. This is a decrease in demand. You're down to 60 pounds per capita now in this simplistic example, and the price is down to $75. Wow. If the only way you'd sell a smaller quantity of product than you sold last year is at a lower price, well, you don't have to have many courses in economics to understand you've got some problems on the demand side. But you just keep that thought in mind, because I'm going to show you in this moment how we spent 20 years doing that. And we need to understand we did it as an industry, and we really need to understand why it didn't get fixed. And I'll try to build that point with you, because I think that's important to your policy and to your strategic planning for the future of this industry. Demand is increasing when both price and quantity consumed increase. If we start from the same $80 market and 65 pounds per capita consumption, then demand is increased if next year, instead of being that blue dot with an implicit sloping demand curve coming through it, we move the blue dot up and to the right, and there's another sloping demand curve coming through it. We can't see that, but it's there. It's operating in the marketplace. So anything, this, for example, is an increase in demand. That's what's starting to happen now. We're offering about the same quantity of product or even a little more than we offered last year on a per capita basis, and prices are up at record high levels. That's coming from demand increases. That's not coming from the fact that we are messing around with the Canadian border again, or we still got BSC issues and can't ship to Japan. When Japan kicks back in again, this thing is going to lurch to the upside again. And you're going to see record prices repeated several times, record high prices repeated several times across the next 5 to 6 years. Has to happen. I don't know how high the calf price is going to go. But whatever record high up around $1.50 we've seen so far, we'll take it out. Count on it. We'll take it out. You see why per capita consumption does not really measure demand in any significant way. We're going to look at some real-world data here. Now, this is a scatter plot, and it looks busy, but this is a really important but simple representation of what's going on in the industry. This is inflation-adjusted prices in cents per pound up and down the vertical axis. This is per capita consumption, and so in here is the price-quantity average for that year. And there's a demand curve, a sloping demand curve, coming this way, going through every one of those. I want you to look now and imagine a sloping demand curve coming through 79. Then just roll down here. Look where we are. Down into the left, remember? Down into the left is bad. Look at 79 through 86. With per capita consumption essentially constant around 78 pounds, inflation-adjusted price for beef at retail had to go down over 30% for the consumer to continue to take it. Are we really saying demand is constant because per capita consumption is constant when the price at which we're moving that quantity of product went down over 30%? This is a shipwreck for the industry. Now, we maintained production. We brought in different types of cattle. We went to bigger cattle. We did a lot of crossbreeding. And we kept the per capita offering up around 7 to 8 pounds. But this was thin ice, and we couldn't sustain that. And all of you know that sometime in the middle 80s, you had a friend, a family member, or a neighbor who went out of the beef cow business. And going from 95 pounds of per capita availability in 1976 down to 63 pounds in the early 1990s, that's about 400,000 average-sized beef cow producers in the United States could run out of money, run out of business. Run out of money was a good way to say it. Run out of business. The beef cow herd went from 46 million down to 33 million. We lost over 30% of our market share when we combined pork, beef, and poultry. Tough, tough times. And you know that from about 86, a lot of cow-calf people had to throw up their hands. They were borrowing money. They were investing the equity in the property and in the land to stay in business. And we downsized dramatically, going from that 7 to 8 pounds all the way down to about 63 across about an 8 to 10 year time period. But that's a movement into the left, and we're still going down into the left. From any starting point up here, the general direction is down. That's bad news. This is just a focus on that acutely bad time period from 79 through 86. I've told many groups around the country across the years that I have never seen an ag commodity that I work with that suffered that type of demand decrease in that short a time period. Not butter with all the cholesterol issues, not eggs with all the cholesterol issues, nothing. You really need to file a thought in the back of your mind. Why in the world was it so bad? What were we doing wrong? We were not changing the product offering to go to a changing consumer. That's what we were doing wrong. And our product fell out of favor, and they said no. And they walked past the beef offering down the pork, or down across that same time period where we went from 95 to 63 pounds of per capita consumption, and the industry was downsized dramatically. Chicken picked up about 35 pounds of per capita consumption. So, in essence, they were walking in and taking the market that we were losing. Per capita consumption, as I've already pointed out, was still at constant around 7 to 8 pounds, and price declined over 30%. One effective way you can think about that is that demand declined 30%, because if quantity is essentially constant and price has to go down that much, you had over 30% decline in demand for beef. And what is that, 7 years inclusive from 79 to 86. Now, starting in 86 then, as I've already said, we went through a different pattern. We downsized, we ran people out of business up through about 1993, and then we went through a period of per capita consumption being constant around 67 pounds, and price plunged again, all the way down through 1997, and actually all the way through 1998. Price was maintained by forcing initially in that time period in the late 80s, early 90s, by downsizing the industry. And then came another period of constant per capita consumption and plunging prices. Focus on per capita consumption as a measure of demand ignores the consumer's willingness to pay. And if you ignore the consumer's willingness to pay, you do it, and you are headed for a disaster, and you're headed for problems as an industry and as an association within the industry. And you've understood that some. You've understood the need to be consumer-driven, and you've done some things about it. Here's the last few years since 98 to 03. Now, basically what we've got here, starting with about 1998, is essentially constant per capita consumption for several years, and price went up over 20%. Now, 03, don't get concerned about 03. The price was so much higher, even with a slight reduction in per capita consumption from about here back toward about 63 pounds, the price was so much higher that that was clearly also an increase in demand. Now, surely we wouldn't argue that across the years since 1998, when there's every evidence that we've added $200 to $250 per head to the value of a fed steer because the demand curve that was through here is shifting up, and out and to the right, surely we wouldn't argue demand is constant just because per capita consumption was essentially constant through 2002. We got to understand it better than that. It's important. Price increased by 20% from 98 to 2003. Willingness to pay has been strong and growing since 1998. I'll show you a website later where I'll post for the industry demand indices on both an annual and quarterly basis. We've got the second quarter of 2004 up, and I will tell you it's up over 22% from the second quarter of 1998, kind of my base year. And like I said, surely we wouldn't argue that demand was constant when we saw that type of price advance with per capita availability and therefore per capita consumption essentially constant for several years. We got a little indicator that cuts through all of this. And I built this for the industry after meeting down in Florida in 1997 with the chairpersons of a bunch of the importer NCBA committees that really started to focus on demand. What can we do about improving the demand situation? And they said to two or three of us from various agriculture economics departments around the country, can you build us a single measure that helps us help producer members understand what's happening in demand? And we said, yes, I think I can build that. And then they said, what will it cost? I said, nothing. Is that cheap enough? That was cheap enough. Actually, in all honesty, it took me about 2 weeks to build the index. My early concerns about it was it doesn't do us any good, I said in that meeting in 1997 down in Florida, if we know demand is shifting up or down, but we don't know why. And the leadership in the industry said, no. We've got to have a simple measure that people can get their mind wrapped around. We'll worry about what's causing it to shift later. They were right and I was wrong, because I think this has done tremendous service this measure has to the industry in terms of people being able to appreciate and understand what's going on. Now, they asked me to do it based on 1980 as a baseline. And when you look at my website, and that's the URL for the website, if you want to put it down and click on demand indexes down at the bottom. And this is also in your material that you've been given out, of course. They wanted 1980 to be the base year. I'll just point out to you that in 1998, after 20 consecutive years of decline, because there's not a single year in there in which the level of this index was above the prior year, not a single year, demand went down for 20 consecutive years. And when it finally bottomed, the index that's 100, set at 100 for 1980, was at 50.2. That means that the cumulative decline in demand was something in the neighborhood of 49.8%. Wow. This means if you had a $3 retail price in 1980, pick any level you want to, that because of declines in demand, that price would have fallen down toward very close to $1.50 before it finally turned. Wow. Something was really badly wrong. And I want to cue your thoughts a little bit. It's awfully difficult to enjoy the steak when you cut off a piece of it and put it in your mouth and chew it, it gets bigger. This industry had a 20 to 25% product failure rate and our fresh choice and select offerings for 20 years. And we didn't do anything appreciable to fix it. You had a major toughness problem. One of the reasons that the CAB program, and I mentioned this explicitly in my presentation, moved forward, helped, was that you have a smaller probability of a product failure performance based on toughness than does the general product out there. And that's basically the big benefit that you have brought and one that you can continue to bring. Now, we need to move beyond that, and we need to continue to fix that problem. And it's starting to get fixed. And that's the reason, I think, that the demand finally turned around in 1998. This is a phenomenally difficult scenario. What can we do as an industry to make sure that customers are willing to pay a price that gives us a chance. Doesn't guarantee anything, but gives you a chance, and that's all you're looking for if you're a good manager, to be profitable and growing as an industry. You have to be consumer-driven, and you have to change the product offering toward where that stupid consumer has gone. You can't sit there and wait for them to decide they're going to go take a course from a home economist and figure out how to cook this tough steak so it'll still be good and expect them to come back to you. If you do that, you're going to suffer the same sort of problems that we saw across that 20-year period when we lost over 30% of the market share from the combined meat and poultry sector. It's got to be safe, it's got to be tender, it's got to have consistent quality, and oh my gracious, it's got to be convenient to prepare. I've told this story around many groups around the country and up in Canada. This is a true story. 5 or 6 years ago, I came home one evening, tore off my jacket, sat down, had a drink. My wife and teenage son sitting there, and my wife says, "The oven's gone." You know, I'm really smart, you know. I said, no, it's not gone. See, it's right over there in the kitchen. That's not what I mean, stupid. That's not exactly what she said, but I cleaned that up a little bit. The element burned out. And I said, oh, we need to fix that, don't we? About 6 months later, I fixed it. About a year later, I opened the same door, walked in with my jacket on, started to take it off, and my wife and son were already up and ready to go out, and they said, "Don't sit down. We got to go out." I said, "What's so urgent that we got to go out?" The microwave quit. Now, if as cattle producers, you don't understand that 90% of the upper, middle income and up families in this country live that way, you're missing a very important point. A chuck roast never comes to my house. What on earth would we do with a chuck roast? I've done, in surveys, I've asked, if you had to take a chuck roast home and use it, what would you pay for it? I get lots of zeros from the upper income families with two adults working outside the home. And they're serious about that. And I left an open end. Why? We don't want to spend the time it takes to take that product and turn it into something acceptable to us. And I get to this story, and somebody in the audience will always raise their hand and say, "Well, you know, some old producer from North Dakota or Texas or wherever the heck, if they'd just take that old chuck roast and throw it in a crock pot that morning, it'd be ready when they got home that evening, and they could maybe use it." And I'm reminding them that here you are, you've got two adults trying to get out into the job market, you've got 1.7 kids there trying to get through the bathroom, you're trying to get your pantyhose on straight, et cetera, et cetera. You're not very interested in going and finding a chuck roast at 7 o'clock that morning and starting the meal preparation that evening. People don't live that way. They start thinking about what they're going to eat in the evening. The surveys clearly indicate sometime between 4:45 and 6 o'clock as they get on the commuter train and start riding home. If you don't have a product offering that fits that need and that microwave prep, you're out of business. And for a long time, we didn't have it because we didn't have any pre-cooked beef items in the stores. And that's starting to change. And along with the export growth, that's why demand has changed, without any question. It's got to be convenient to prepare. I've known that for 15 to 20 years. I've known how important that is. I've talked about it. I've done research on it. And I still believe that when we look back on this period, we will have to conclude we underestimated its importance. If you got income, you will pay for reduced time in meal preparation. That's a very positive and strong income elasticity, as we call it. When our incomes go up, we will pay for convenience. We will pay for service. I'm worried we're going to get to the point that they want it pre-eaten. Because we've already got it pre-cooked and ready. But convenience is a really, really big driver here. And it will continue to be because the percentage of families with two wage earners outside working outside the household is going to continue to grow. It's already up in the 67% range, and it's going to continue to grow. The increases in demand since 1998, when the demand mix index finally bottomed just above 50, were clearly in response to improved quality control, guaranteed tenderness, clear real-world evidence of how important the toughness problem was, is one of the first things several of the vertical alliances have done is guaranteed tenderness. Now, that's vivid, real-world in the marketplace testimony to how important that is. The meat scientists were saying by the mid to late 1980s, yeah, that's right. If we do shear tests, about 20 to 25% of the select and short cuts are simply too tough to chew. The shear test is above 10. You can't eat it when it's up there. I tell people that the only thing that I will buy in my market in the Blacksburg area, and I shop primarily at big, upscale, modern, new Kroger stores, the only thing I can buy in that beef counter that I can trust will be good and edible when I put it on the grill is fillets, and they usually run $16.99 a pound. So I'm not a person that does a lot of grilling beef, believe it or not, because I've tried the ribeyes. I can't eat them. About a fourth of the time, I can't eat them. I've tried the strip steaks. And then I start raising these questions. I go in, there's a Delmonico, and there's a Porterhouse, and there's a Kansas City strip and a New York strip. I said, what are all of these things, and what do I do with them? How can I prepare them? And you got to appreciate the fact that most consumers don't have a clue. London broil is top round in this part of the world. It's flank steak in Texas. I've asked people that I worked with at the retail level, look at this London broil cut here. Nice and red looking, lean looking. Boy, that's a fine looking cut of beef. I said, what if somebody takes it home and tries to grill it? They'll say, meat managers. They're not going to do that. That's round steak. It's called London broil. How am I supposed to know I can't grill it? I'm a dumb consumer. Well, I need to learn better than... No. Don't make the consumer go do a short course in beef preparation, fix it so they can't screw up, and make it idiot-proof. Well, what do I do? Well, you go get somebody who's professional to help you redesign your display case. And at a very minimum, segment the display case into things you can grill and the things you have to fix this way, and give them some nicely done little professional tips there on how to prepare it. And that little chain with about 25 stores in Virginia and Mid-Atlantic is doing real well in that beef offering since then. We got to understand that we got to go to the consumer. Don't sit and wait for them to come to you. Because what we found out, they'll just leave you and stay gone. They don't have to buy beef. And they're not going to buy beef if they've got a big question mark about its performance, its consistency, and the quality of that eating experience. They'll buy something else. And they did buy something else. No doubt that the futures industry is tied to the extent to which you go to them and don't sit there with the same product offering. Closer trim cut now on a white styrofoam pad with plain plastic over it. Nothing nice about the packaging. And blood and purge running out the corner. And this nicely dressed consumer that comes by the grocery store on the way home from the evening is holding it out like that as he or she puts it in the tray so it makes sure it won't spill on them. My gracious folks, that's not the way the modern potential consumer with income to pay for your product wants to see it prepared and offered to them. And I just planted thought, they started coming back to us and demand started to increase when we finally started seeing some of these quality control pre-cooked items go out there. And a lot of them come from the end meats where we were really struggling. It's a pre-cooked pot roast, beef roast. Tyson is doing it. Hormel is doing it. Lots of people are doing it. Kroger even have their own brand, and somebody's packaging it for them now. That's where it's coming from. I buy a lot of those. They go through the microwave. We live that way, but I also try them all when they come. I haven't found one of those yet. It's tough. I don't know what they do to it in the process of getting cooked and packaged, but it's never tough. Never tough. So they're doing something to it. I don't care what it is, as long as it's not dangerous and I trust it isn't. Okay? We've got to offer them something they want and are willing to pay for. Want and are willing to pay for. You've got to do that. That's what being consumer-driven means. Let's turn to how the industry's changed and think about how those changes, I think, relate to this turn in demand that we finally saw. You got a producer on the left end where you are, and you got a consumer up at the top end, and you got profit centers in the middle. The historical of this industry has been organized such that price is supposed to bring some coordination and quality control to that supply chain. That it's supposed to be price that somehow we interpret what the consumer wants and send a signal to back down to the producer. Well, we couldn't send a signal back down to the producer that put a premium on the tender beef cut and a price discount on the tough cut because we didn't ever change the grades to put tenderness in the choice and select grades. My, what a mistake. What a mistake. Where was our academic partners in terms of trying to get this sort of stuff changed? We've dropped the ball for you there. USDA will not change the grades unless the industry demands they be changed. You really think the Texas cattle feeders are going to come to Washington and want to put a 10 in the score in choice grade? They're not going to fare very well under that system. Kansas State guys estimate that they're getting about $2 a hundredweight on average too much for their cattle. And Nebraska is getting about $2 a hundredweight on average too little for their cattle. And we've got about $35 million income transfer essentially going from Nebraska to Texas. Now, Texas and New Mexico and the Panhandle of Oklahoma and Southwest Kansas are going to get involved in NCBA or in any other forum and come to Washington and demand that we put tenderness in the choice grade so we can finally let the price system work for us? No way. We tried to get the beef maturity cattle out of the select and choice grades a few years ago, and they damn near shot each other over it. You know, if you can sell an old heiferette that's already had a calf and gone into the herd and you decide she's not going to be a good cow and you put it back in the feed yard for 75 days and she makes select, you can make a lot of money on those cattle. Well, those folks don't want a change. You know, it's still pretty much I'm out for myself and I'm not really all that concerned about how well the industry fares. There's still too much of that out there. We've got a problem. We've got profit centers along here that hate each other, try to fool each other, try to cheat each other. And I would really encourage you, and I use this in my crisis, how would you organize this supply chain and the functions along it, starting with the cow-calf function all the way up to the consumer, if you own the whole industry? Now, if you're in here at the top end of this, and you're Tyson, or you're XL, or you're a smaller packer that thinks you can do a high-valued, quality-assured, branded, fresh item to the consumer that they'll pay your premium for, and you say, well, but these people down on this end are not giving me the type of cattle I need to support this new product initiative, you'd change it, wouldn't you? You'd get your son or your daughter, your nephew, or whoever's running this end of the program down here, and hey, shape up. We got to get some quality consistency here. I can't do quality assured guaranteed up here if the raw material down at the bottom end, which is the fed steer heifer, is all over the board. And it's all over the board. So now you're starting to appreciate and understand why the people up here, the big packers, before they finally started spending billions of dollars on developing new products, and they've spent billions on it across the next last 8 to 10 years, mark my word, billions. They didn't ever do that until they abandoned the failed pricing system, and we let it fail because we're pricing everything on averages and the grades don't even identify product attributes of primary importance to consumers. And they went to written agreements and formulas and grids and contracts and got into alliances. If you step over into pork, it's more obvious. Smithfield, located here in the state, is the giant in the pork business, and they vertically integrated where they own production facilities. They've got 70% of their hog kill from the same set of genetics that they went to UK and bought about 10, 12 years back. With that type of quality control, they got into the Japanese market. They were never able to get there before. You ought to look at the stock performance of Smithfield. Now, there's independent hog producers in the state that don't like Smithfield for some obvious reasons. But look at the stock performance. They've done extremely well. I think we'll continue to do well. But we've got legislation pending in Washington that would outlaw them owning a hog. Just a final thought with you. If you pass that legislation and Smithfield has to get rid of all of their production facilities and they can't own a hog, see, this is some of the changes I told you some of you wouldn't like. They can't own a hog so they can really get some quality control. How many billions of dollars do you think they're going to be willing to spend in the future on product development if we force them to buy the random offering out in the live hog market or the live cattle market? Think about that. See, that's the thing that I was talking about when I said the way pricing is done and the way valuation is done and the way you function in the marketplace is going to change some. It's going to have to change some. That doesn't advance. I'm going to try this one. A 20 to 25% product failure rate persisted for 25 years and is only now starting to improve. The alliances have helped that. You've helped that. We're seeing some other developments now where the pre-cooking product, et cetera, is starting to improve that. CAB was a move in that direction of quality control. And I think without any question, it helps processors understand the potential. There was a rep from one of the big three packers, go back about 3 or 4 or 5 years now, maybe 6 years, time flies. In a 6 month period, I probably spent 20 hours on the phone with him. Him paying the phone bill, I couldn't. But he called me and wanted to talk about what is it we can do that would turn us around at the consumer level. He called one day and he said, what's the potential? What can I take into my boardroom and to my CEO to give them some idea of what the upside is here? I said, well, look how deep the hole is we fell into. You know, it's almost 50% decline we found. If you can turn that back up, theoretically, that's 50%. I mean, if you just got out of that hole, got back where we were in 1980, the potential is almost infinite and it's huge. And he's, that'll help me. He was looking for numbers, and I was trying to provide him with numbers, and he quit calling after a while. And I know they've done substantial things, not only then, but before then, and since then in particular, in terms of their product offering. Future will see more sophisticated coordination, quality control, and product innovation strategies than are characterized by a continual demise of the price-driven system, non-price coordination mechanisms such as contracts, investments in new technology at every function level. Every function along that supply chain will probably have to invest in some new technology to get this quality-assured product. Written performance standards and related compensations. They're not going to rely on the fair pricing system to do this. So you might as well hide and watch. If this industry goes forward, it'll go forward because we are coordinating and getting quality control outside the existing price system. We need to think about why the industry is moving away from a price-driven system. The quality grades have not been changed to reflect the changing interests and lifestyles of consumers. That's a failure. That's a policy failure. That's our fault. That's USDA's fault. We can't reasonably expect the competing factions in the industry to form 100% consensus and come and demand a grade change. The last time we changed the quality grades was in 1976, and we changed them in the wrong direction because we lowered model requirements, which hurt predictable performance of the product. No chance of an industry consensus to do things like put a 10 in the score in choice grade. It's not going to happen. In about the price system provided for coordination and quality control effectively was killing the interest by the huge packers and processors and new quality assured and branded fresh beef offerings. If they didn't have some consistency coming in this door so they could have some consistency in the new product offering going out the back door, they weren't going to spend money on new product efforts. And they didn't for a long time. So that's why it persisted. Nobody along that supply chain saw any profit-based economic reason to make the huge investments and change it. And finally, after it got so bad, the potential was so great that we finally climbed over some of those hurdles and started to change things a little bit, and that's why we're in much better shape today. Keep doing that. Went through that one. Billions of dollars invested in new products in the past 10 to 12 years, but this has not happened until the done price means of coordination, like the contracts and alliances, had brought some quality control. 23% increase in demand since 1998 is based on national and state organization efforts to facilitate new products and on huge dollars invested by the big processors and by smaller value-added companies. Two paths we can follow. We can legislate and regulate to force a return to the market-based price-driven system, or we can accept the change. That's why you've got to step up and think about this. Accept the change to non-price approaches that bring coordination and quality control. From a producer's viewpoint, they're traders. If you want to keep that feeling of independence, you want to be in this commodity market and in a price-driven system. If you want to be part of a growing industry, you probably have to be willing to get involved in a contract or alliance. If you want to be consumer-driven, that's where it's going to happen. If you want to get in a situation where you probably have to make new investments to scan your cattle and do some things to sort based on quality, etc., require new technology, you probably have to be over there. And if you're going to get any assured benefits to the technology, you've probably got to be over there, so you've got a written arrangement with whoever's buying that they guarantee to give you something for what you're adding in terms of value and improved predictability of performance. You can't make a million-dollar investment in technology and hope that this messed-up pricing system will send you something in return for that investment. You're going to have to probably do this in written agreements with your newfound partners along the supply chain. And the particular interface that's particularly important is where the fed cattle come out of the feed yards and go to the packer. Because the packer's the one that's spending the money on the new product development and innovating in that way, and they've got to get the cattle they need to support that initiative. That's exactly what the alliances are trying to do. If you want to stay in the commodity cattle, you need to vote for the price-driven system. Now, see, I wish we had a price-driven system that was running all this. But I understand that we don't have one that works. So I don't want to hook myself to that if it's going to take me down with it. And that's what I'm saying to you. We didn't do the things we needed to do in terms of policy and changes to allow the price-driven system to work. That's the reality of the situation as we stand here in September 2004. And you need to think about that. If you want premiums for quality, you're probably going to get it over there and not in the price-driven system. If you want to punish the packers, if you feel like that's the objective, then you ought to vote for legislation that forces us back to some sort of competitive price system that we don't even have out there. But that's what the proposed legislative initiatives are calling for. If you want to discourage the packers from making those billions of dollars investment in new product offers, just stay with the old failed pricing system, and that's going to happen. If you want to protect investment, compensate better, compete better with chicken, and you need to build this, you're going to be like your grandparents. Produce the type of cattle that you want to produce because you like the looks of them, and you haven't thought much about what they're really doing on the breaking table and what they're doing going on through the system, then you want to stay with the price-driven system. And let me see where I am here. One, and I'm going to have 10, 12 minutes for questions. Looking ahead, I'm going to predict. We will see record high prices repeated over and over again several times across the next 6 years. It's going to happen because we are headed into a building phase of the cattle cycle, and we're going to get caught with increased demand in the domestic market and Japan coming back again right at the time when we've got a smaller supply of beef than we've had largely in our lifetime on a per capita basis. It's going to ram prices to the upside, and it's going to be pulled on up, and encouragement's going to be given to build this herd by these demand increases we're finally getting. We'll have opportunities to invest profits at the cow-calf level in better genetics, and I hope that happens. If the cow-calf person is going to be holding the resource in this industry that's in tighter supply for the next 5 to 6 years, and it's going to get tighter as we hold some heifers back and start to build a herd. So, and with cheap corn out there, and with this demand thing going on in beef, and the supply side cycle at work now, I don't know how high calf prices are going to go, but if the racket out there now, maybe for 500-pound steers, $1.50, we'll go above that across the next few years. It's going to be really hard on the cattle feeder and the processor. And the cow-calf people are going to be laughing all the way to the bank. And you're going to say, it's about time. So just enjoy it while it lasts because, you know, it won't last forever. I trust and hope that the packer ban legislation, this legislation that would preclude packers from owning cattle or hogs, and another piece of legislation that would preclude them from using contracts to specify quality, etc., and have a price grid on quality characteristics and buy cattle that way, I presume that those pieces of legislation are going to fail, and they should. We're going to see, then, investments, continued investments by processors and new parks. And boy, the producer has to have somebody along the supply chain willing to spend money on doing all of the investigation work and putting out always risky new product offerings. There's never any guarantee of success on those. They're not going to do that unless they feel good about the way they can coordinate, control quality, get the type of cattle they need, etc., to support their product offerings. So I think this one and this one are closely interrelated. I think this will fail. If it passes, you can mark this one out, because they're not going to be willing to make investments in new product offerings at the same level they have in recent years. I think per capita consumption will go down toward 60 pounds before it turns and starts to increase. I don't want you to feel bad about that, even though it's another little loss of market share. We've got to hold some heifers before we can build a herd and have the chance for big industry down the road. When we hold a heifer back and take off a slaughter truck, beef production is going to go down. Or at best, stay about constant. And as population increases about 1% a year, per capita consumption is going to come down. Before the Japanese market was closed, back last October, the USDA's estimate of per capita consumption of beef in 2004 was just a little bit above 62 pounds. When the Japanese market closed, that went up to about 67 pounds. Because if we can't ship it to Japan, we have to eat it here. And the way we get to per capita consumption, we take beginning inventory, we add production, we add imports, and then we subtract ending inventory and exports, and we get a disappearance number for the year, and we divide it by population. So if that export number goes down, more of it's going to stay here. And we've had to eat that added 4 pounds or so, and we've done it at record high prices. Of course, beef prices up around $4 and better, which speaks really well for what kind of shape we're in at consumer demand level right now. I think demand will continue to increase, and it will if all these things happen. Producers are going to have a good chance at profits. We're going to start to take back a few years out. When we get the herd build up bigger, we'll start to take back some lost market share, and we're going to have something to leave your sons and daughters. And that's something I think that's always important to you. And it should be, and you'd a whole lot rather leave them a hunk of a growing, vibrant, vital chance for profit industry than the one we had prior to about 1998. You've got that, and that's how you can get in touch with me. If you wanted to jot down a website that gets you to my weekly market advisory letter, it's www.ext. .bt.edu and click on news. And among other things that comes up will be the For Sale Weekly Letter. It goes up fresh every Tuesday afternoon. And I've got 8 minutes and 9 seconds. I've got a digital timer on me up here. They didn't tell me what's going to happen if that thing goes to zero, but I'm not willing to chance it either. So any questions or complaints or rejoinders or whatever it might be out there. Yes. We are moving toward more free trade. We're moving toward a posture that Australia, for example, is going to compete harder for the Japanese market. And other countries are going to be trying to tap into some of these markets we've got. I think we'll fare pretty well. Because basically what we do in this country is import processing beef to the extent of roughly 10% of our production. And then we export generally high quality product, not altogether, but generally high quality product, again, to the extent of about 9-10% of our production. I kind of like the idea of importing, if we have to, low-price processing beef and exporting the high-price, high-value product. And I think that's the role we'll be in. And Australia and New Zealand and Argentina and the other places, and Brazil and other places, aren't yet ready to compete totally effectively with us in the world market for this marble, high-quality beef that you produce. I think we're going to be okay. I think export demand will continue to grow out toward that 2010 time frame. Okay? Doesn't mean we'll necessarily export more, because we're not going to have a whole lot of it, remember. But I think the price of exports will be strong, and that helps boost our price domestically and helps bring demand up. I'm okay with that. I'm willing to compete. Yes? I think they both had a negative impact on consumer demand. Without any question, we were arguing in 76 that we ought to be able to get Short's cattle now and not have the Marvin have to go up because the cattle are so young, and that was a mistake. The purveyors and the people who are trying to use this product to go in the institution market, et cetera, were telling us at the time, you're screwing up. We screwed up. I think there's some fairly convincing evidence out there now, and I'm aware of a colleague or two who's worked on some of this, that indicates you tend to have more of a toughness problem when you use growth hormones. There are people in the room who don't hear me say that, I'm sure. I just said it, so you don't have to come and tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. I think I do. It is a bit of a problem, and maybe what we need to do there is find a way to enhance that production development without having, if it is in fact true, that small, at the margin, maybe negative impact on tenderness. Because I think the evidence says it's there. Absolutely. Absolutely. Perception is important in addition to actual performance. I'm glad you expanded me there because you're absolutely right. See, it was early on, after 79 and 80, one of the problems was everybody's concerned about cholesterol. In 1974, we could have been here, nobody in the room had known that cholesterol number. I bet if I asked, over half the hands in the room would go up the fastest now. And just because we don't hear it quite as much now as we used to, don't mean it's gone away. It's still not going away. It's still there. So, yeah, you're right about that. You're right about that. We went the wrong way. Now, I can't answer whether in net the enhanced productivity coming from the growth hormones at the individual firm level have made us more profitable because it's more than offset. Whatever, at the margin, small impact it had on consumer demand. I don't know how to answer that. I don't know how to sort it out. But I do think I clearly know the direction that use of hormones, a direction of the impact on consumer demand that use of hormones has. It's clearly negative. 3 minutes and 32 seconds. Yes, sir. You say poultry hasn't done well in alliances? I'm saying poultry doesn't have alliances. Poultry is vertically integrated. Tyson owns all of it. The producer is a contract producer. That's not an alliance. That's a vertically integrated structure. You might argue they don't have much independence and they don't have much protection in the contracts, and all of those things are there sometimes, but their revenue stream over time has probably been more stable than if they'd been hooked to the marketplace, so they have to decide. You're not going that way. Alliances don't go that way. What alliances do is bring the different profit centers into the same room and almost act as if if this one firm, this one entity owned the whole supply chain. And then they look for coordination and quality control and look for ways they can compensate cattle producers who can deliver high quality cattle if this is a quality alliance. And I've looked at some of those data and I've worked with some of those groups, and I can tell you that the producer of high quality cattle, like much a big proportion of your Angus cattle, fare very well in those situations. They're not in the commodity business. They are in a little bit of the differentiated product business because the product coming out of those cattle will bring a premium in the marketplace. You're going to lose a little independence. I said that. You've got to decide. Do I want to be independent and hard-nosed thinking and be in the failed price-driven system and be in the commodity business? Or do I want to change my way of operating and thinking, be willing to change it a little bit and get in some of these coordinated efforts? You've got to decide that. I'm telling you that I think the future of this industry, because the price system is not adequate to do what needs to be done, to give the premiums, to do the coordination, to provide for quality control, I'm telling you that I think the future of this industry is in some of these non-price arrangements that involve some contracts, some written agreements, some compensation schemes that's laid out between the participating profit centers. Does that help? Okay. 1 minute, 16 seconds. I got enough time for another question. You can't get me. Yes. Pardon? He's asking how the feed situation is going to affect the cattle industry across the next 6 months. I don't think it's going to be anything but a positive. We don't have any supply management anymore. We're probably going to see 11 billion bushel corn crop before this year's over. Life says the report has it at 10.96 billion bushels. Now, usage is getting up toward 10 billion bushels, and I understand all that. But I see, relatively speaking, cheap corn out in front of us. Now, you got to keep in mind that when you got cheap corn, you feed more of it, you feed a high percentage of the calves that you could feed, all of that stuff, and we increase feed supplies, and other things equal, cheap corn means cheap cattle somewhere down the road. But here, we caught with the numbers being such an important phenomenon, we can't increase the beef supplies domestically quickly across the next several years. So I'm not concerned about it. I think it's going to be okay. 3, 2, 1, done. Good luck. Thank you.